Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for your invitation at the Lab Debate Center. I must say that I never was lucky enough to spend some time at the Lab Debate Center, and I would have liked to spend some time. So it's a pleasure for me to be here today. And I don't know where Cambridge, and I should know it better. So when I was asked to come and make a presentation, I was asked to select a topic, and I chose to present you a topic that I'm working on, and it's more a work in progress than anything. So I'm going to be also happy that we can have a discussion and so we can have interactions. And it's a topic which is evolving, and I'm going to sort of address certain issues which seems to me to be important. What I think also is interesting with this topic is that it's at the crossroads of different bodies of law. So it's international organizations, it's governance issues, it's economic law, but it's also dispute settlement, it's also human rights. And I'm going to show you that, in fact, and we all know that, in international law everything is linked more and more, and that's what is interesting with these kind of topics. So it's sort of a laboratory for looking at the interactions between different rules of international law. Now, to start with the topic, we all know that international organizations are doing more and more, are conducting more and more activities. There are more and more demands on them to conduct new types of activities. And if you look at the constitutive charters of the international organizations, and then you look at the profile of their current activities, you're quite often surprised that the evolution, that there's been such an evolution in terms of the profile and the practice of international organizations. What is also interesting, and that's going to be more the focus of my presentation today, is that what we see that the international organizations have developed their own way of developing their law, the internal law of international organizations. So that's one aspect which is interesting. And I think there are issues of legitimacy that could be discussed. They also, and this is something that I will address very soon, they also have developed control mechanisms, accountability mechanisms. And what is also important is that more and more the activities of international organizations are going to have incidence effects on the daily life of individuals. And they're going to affect the interests or the rights of individuals. You have all in mind the issues of targeted sanctions enacted by the Security Council and the CADI decisions. That's an example. But in fact, if you look at the profile of other international organizations, for example, the World Bank, you're going to see that there are activities which can have similar effects on the rights of individuals. And that's going to be one of the angles of my presentation. Now, what I said about the internal law of international organization is that, and I will take more specifically the case of the World Bank, but it's quite interesting that the institution has enacted different set of practices, legal practices, policy practices, which have a direct implication on the daily life of states and the populations of these states. And it can be the operational standards of an internationalization, it can be directed, they can be named directives, they can be dealing with audit issues, they can be dealing with resource management issues. So there, I think it's quite interesting that for the time being, I think we international lawyers have not yet enough explored the internal life of international organizations and sort of try to address the issue of the applicable law. It has this applicable law within the international organization has a lot of links and interactions with the international legal order. And the point, and one of the points of this topic, of this presentation, is that in fact there is a lot of permeability, of porosity between the international legal order and the internal law of an international organization. Now, another point which is interesting is that when we speak of the applicable law, we speak of the notion of the rule of law. But in fact, the understanding of the notion of the rule of law should be broad and should also encompass the remedies. The remedies that can be accessed when there is an issue of non-respect of the law of the international organization. And there is something to be said about the continuum. It's quite interesting if you look at the practice of the World Bank is that for each set of standards or policies or directives, the bank has put in place a specific type of remedy. So there is a sort of continuum between the applicable law, the applicable standards, and the remedy. Now, the remedies can be varied, and they have different profile. If you think of operational standards of the World Bank, and you might know that the inspection panel of the World Bank there, because of the type of standards which are enacted, which deal mostly with environmental and social issues. The bank in 1993 put in place an accountability mechanism, which is the inspection panel, which mostly has investigation powers. And then there are corrective measures which can be taken by the World Bank. But if you, for example, look at a recent decision by the World Bank, it's quite an interesting one. There has been a dramatic shift in the policy of the bank in terms of access to information. Michael has just stressed this issue of confidentiality. I will come back to that. But it's quite interesting that in 2010, the bank has decided that, as a principle, everything should be made accessible to the public. So it's a sort of revolution for this institution. And what is interesting is that the principle is that access to information, transparency, with some exceptions. And because there are some exceptions, there might be some contestation about the interpretation of the exceptions. So a specific mechanism has been put in place, which is the Access to Information Committee. Okay, so that's an example of a specific remedy. But it was considered that it was not enough, because maybe that an individual, a corporation, would not be pleased because of the decision taken by the Access to Information Committee. So an appeals board has also been put in place, an appeals board composed of external people who will be deciding about the fact, you know, if the bank was right or not to give the information. So the point I want to make is that we have a wide range of different regulatory instruments which are used by institutions, and there is also a vast array of mechanisms which are put in place so to play the role of a remedy within the organization. So that means that there is an order which is developing itself within the World Bank with this type of procedures which are put in place. And what I think is interesting is to look at the profile of these procedures. And I'm going to be looking at a special procedure, the one dealing with corruption and fraud, because I think that it's quite a good example too, where the bank decided at some point that something should be done about corruption. I will come back to that. And then because it was dealing and enacting new practices in terms to struggle against corruption and fraud, decided also that there should be a remedy for the ones who were sanctioned by the bank. So there too you have this link, which is this continuum link, which has been established between the applicable law and access to justice. So for presenting this sanction procedure, which is, as Michael said, not really known in the external world of the World Bank, what I'm going to do is to present the sort of context of the establishment of this procedure. Then I will look at some features of this procedure. And what I'd like to highlight is that the features show that there is a trend towards creating a judicial procedure. And this is something that I would come back to in the conclusion, is that in a way international organizations can't escape from due process requirements as interpreted in the human rights circles and other circles. So that's something that I will stress. Now, the last point of this presentation, I will address some of the reasons why there is this trend towards judicialization of this procedure. So to come to the establishment of this procedure, I call it an ex nihilo establishment procedure because everything really started at the end of the 90s, so not too long ago. And it's interesting, I was at the bank before Michael, between 95 and 99, and still in 95 it was quite interesting to see that nobody would dare to speak about corruption, because the current general counsel at that time, Ibrahim Shata, would say this is interference in domestic affairs of the state. You should not deal with this issue. In fact, at the same time, we had a president at the bank who was James Wolfensohn. He was one of the greatest presidents of the World Bank. And James Wolfensohn said, but we have to address the issue of corruption. This is a sort of cancer for economic development, and we should address it. And this is also quite interesting in the life of an internationalization, because as soon as it was accepted at the political level that corruption should be dealt with by the World Bank, immediately the institution adopted the tools for dealing with this issue. So what did the organization do to deal with the issue of corruption? It first, the board of directors of the World Bank first adopted a strategy. And if you look at the strategy, it was normative in a way that it had to define what was corruption, what was fraud, and so on. It was operational because it was also thought that the bank should also be preventing this type of activities to happen. So development assistance and technical assistance were framed for combating corruption. And then, as an element of the strategy, it was also decided that there should be a sanction procedure. It should be a sanction procedure. So to sanction the individuals and the corporations who would be conducting corruption or fraud practices. So the idea of the sanction, and this is quite interesting that Michael referred to that, it's exclusion, debarment. Okay, so that meant that the bank, right from the beginning, considered that there was an interest for companies to be working with the World Bank because of the volume of business and activities conducted by the World Bank. So the sanction would be exclude them from this business activity, would they not abide to certain practices in terms of struggle against corruption and fraud. Now, what is interesting is that this procedure was developed as a step-by-step approach. And first, as a first step, at the end of the 90s, they had to define what was corruption, what was fraud. And then later on, in 2004, they added coercion, they added collusion, so, and they added the practice of obstruction. So there we see that there is an evolutive mandate of the World Bank was dealing with these issues. So that was done, and that was done through specific guidelines and directives, so internal documents of the bank. If you look at them, it's quite interesting because there is no reference to the UN Convention and the OECD Convention. So it's quite interesting to see that they wanted to have this internal definition of these practices. There might be an issue of legitimacy, I think. Now, at the second step, after defining what were the practices and which how they should be qualified, they defined what the procedure and what should be done for sanctioning an individual or a corporation which would be violating the law of the organization. And it started with a mechanism which was rather primitive. It was there was first an investigation branch, which would be conducting investigation, often accused of being too secret, too confidential, and I will come back to that. And then there was they set up a sanctions committee. But this, at that time in 90, that was at the end of the 90s, the sanctions committee was composed of 7 persons from the World Bank. Okay, so internal mechanism with people from the organization deciding about what to do and how to sanction the ones which would not be abiding to the directives of the World Bank. Now, this step-by-step approach changed, evolved because in 2004, because of external audits, and I will come back to the role played by external audits, there was a dramatic change of this procedure, and the procedure now is a two-tiered structure, has a two-tiered structure, and you have the chart here, it's a double page. And and that what is interesting is that you still have the investigation phase. You have now, then in terms of sanction, you have the creation of the position of an evaluation and suspension officer who is a World Bank employee, who has a role to play in terms of assessing the evidence put by the investigation branch and deciding about the possible sanction. And then the evaluation, the decisions of the evaluation and suspension officer can be contested, can be appealed before a board. So you have a second tier mechanism which was put in place. So that is interesting because that addressed one of the concerns that was made about this procedure is that it's an internal mechanism, but we should also have access to justice. We should be able to appeal a decision which is not to our interest, and that was addressed by the World Bank. Now, if you look at the role of the board, the sanctions board, they can conduct a de novo review of the case. So they will start again and look at the evidence which has been gathered. And what is also interesting is that the sanctions board can hold a hearing so that there too there is a possibility for the corporation or the individual to be heard by the sanctions board. Now, what is also interesting from a legal viewpoint is that the decision of the evaluation and suspension officer, if they are not contested before the sanctions board, are final. The same with the decisions of the sanctions board. They're final, and they have to be implemented. Now, the other thing which is interesting with this procedure is that the names of the companies and individuals subject to the debarment or the exclusion, which is put in place through this procedure, are published on the website of the bank. So the publicity is an element which is important in the sanction, which has been framed in the context of this procedure. That means that if you go and look at the website of the World Bank, you will see the list of the names of the companies and people who are no more able to work with the World Bank because of corruption and fraud practices. There is another development which has taken place recently, which is also interesting. It's called the possibility of doing referral reports. And what does it mean? It means that the investigation branch, when it has compiled the evidence, when it's at some point, will send a letter to the concerned government or to the concerned donor agency. So to inform the state or the donor agency of practices of fraud or corruption. And this I find interesting because the idea of sending this referral report to states, to the concerned states, is a way to inform the state and to induce the state to conduct on its own territory, under its own jurisdiction, an action against a company or an individual which is conducting corruption activities. It seems to me that it's interesting, and I think that we have to still to explore what it means, but it means that you will have interaction between domestic courts and the decisions taken in the context of the World Bank by the evaluation officer or by the sanction board. And I've always been wondering, and that may be something that we can discuss, what is really the value of the legal value of the decisions of the sanctions board, for example, before domestic courts? And how should they be looked at? And I think that this is also going to have some effects on arbitration disputes and arbitration decisions, because we have more and more issues of corruption which are brought in the context of investment disputes. And the fact that some companies have been debarred by the World Bank might have some implication on the qualification of corruption as stated by an investment arbitral tribunal. So that was the presentation of this procedure and the evolution. Now, what is interesting is to look at the nature of this procedure and the qualification. And this is quite interesting because when you look at the way the bank framed this procedure, it's said in a lot of documents which are public, you would see that it's a mix of different, they've done a mix of different legal traditions, different legal practices. And they have borrowed a lot from domestic law. So I don't think that international law has played an important role. But international law played an important role with respect to the general principles of law, with respect to due process, with respect to fairness, and so on. But mostly, the idea was to look at what was done at the domestic level and to sort of frame something within the organization. And it's interesting to see that the bank is putting a lot of emphasis on the qualification of this procedure as an administrative procedure. But the understanding of administrative might vary from one order to another one. I think that when you look at the definition of the administrative nature of the procedure, it's interesting because it's mostly an a contrario definition which is given. Meaning what? Meaning that it's different from a criminal procedure, because the sanctions are different. It's not criminal penalties, it's not imprisonment, it's not so. That means that for the bank, it's not a criminal procedure. But in a way, the way that the bank has qualified It's the practices of fraud and corruption. It's quite similar to domestic criminal procedures. So is it really an administrative procedure, or is it not an administrative procedure with some criminal features? This is something that I think should be looked at more carefully. Now, what I think is also interesting is that the standard of proof is going to be different, and the mens rea is different from a criminal procedure. So this is where maybe that there is a difference between what the bank is doing and what a criminal tribunal would be doing at the domestic level with respect to corruption. And another difference maybe is that the investigative branch does not have executive powers, and in domestic orders that would be different. So a so-called administrative procedures, but it's an administrative procedure which has been judicialized, and I'm going now to switch to look at these various elements, is that over the time, remember that it was established quite recently at the end of the 90s, okay? But there have been some changes. And it's interesting to see that the changes are all going towards the direction of establishing a judicial procedure or a quasi-judicial procedure. Elements of assertion for stressing this judicial character of the corruption procedure. The elements of due process. When it was established, there was not much about the opportunity, the right to be heard by individuals and corporations, or the right to defend its case, to be able to defend his or her case before the sanctions committee. But that has been integrated, and in 2004 it was really it was set up and integrated in the procedure. So what we've seen is that we've seen a proceduralization of this procedure in accordance with the right to a fair trial criteria. Now, that's one element which is interesting. The second element is that it's the two-tier procedure approach. Remember what I said about 1998 when the procedure was put in place? It was rather primitive, okay? Now, in 2004, there has been an evolution, and if you look at the flow chart, you will see that you have this first tier, and you have the second tier. And this is also interesting, and this is something all for us international lawyers, because more and more we're speaking of a hill in the investment field, we have that in the trade field and so on. And the question was, is it a standard of international law, this two-tier approach? I would dare to say yes, but we don't have much practice for the time being, okay? We have that for criminal tribunals, of course, we have this two-tier approach, but not yet in other areas. But what is interesting is that if you look at the practice in domestic orders, you will see that the trend has been towards a two-tier approach or a three-tier approach in terms of access to justice for individuals. And so that means that there has been an influence, and the influence is coming more from the domestic orders practice than from the international order. Although there are elements, I think if you look carefully at the practice of the decisions of the European Court of Human Rights, you will see some indication towards this idea that there should be this element of a two-tier procedure is an element of due process. Now, the other element which is interesting when you look at the two-tier approach is that it's the idea that they had this two-tier approach, they put in place this two-tier approach mostly for pragmatic reasons. And when they evaluated the functioning of the procedure, they realized that the procedure was not enough developed, so the delays were very long, it was very complex and so on. And they decided that they should put in place this two-tier approach where the evaluation officer would be able to screen all the cases and decide what to do. And then there would be a possibility of appeal before a sanction board. For the time being, the evaluation officer is still a person from the World Bank. And is it in accordance with the judicial character of such a procedure? Not sure, okay? And I think that maybe that's going to be an element of the evolution of this practice. Now, what I think is also interesting with this two-tier approach is that they decided that the second tier should be qualified as an independent mechanism, impartial mechanism. And there was an issue of the composition of the sanctions board. Right at the beginning, the World Bank in 98 had the choice between having a board only composed of external people or a board composed of internal people. The bank chose the approach of the internal people, people nominated, appointed from the World Bank. Now, in 2004, the bank chose to have a majority of the majority of people from the World Bank and some external people. In 2004, it changed. It was a majority of people from the external side, external world, with some people from the World Bank. But the bank has still kept this idea of having people from the World Bank sitting on the sanctions board. And this, I think, is interesting because there too, I think that there is room for evolution. I'm not so sure that it's going to be tenable for the World Bank still to have a sanctions board, an appeal mechanism, which looks like a jurisdiction composed of people coming from the institution which is accusing an individual or a corporation. So what happened is that for the time being we have a majority of external people, and the presidency of the sanction board also was usually, the presidency was assumed by someone from the World Bank. This has changed now. It's someone from the external world which should be chairing the meeting of the sanctions board. Is it enough in terms of guarantee of impartiality and independence? This is an open question. There is something which is interesting to look at. It's the code of conduct of the members of the sanctions board. It's also a public document. And if you look at it, you will see that there is an importance which is put on the notion of fairness, impartial, and due diligence conduct, and the fact that they should be acting in total independence. Another element of this composition of the sanction board is the fact that at the beginning it was not composed by judges, and it was not to be composed by former judges or arbitrators coming from the external world. Now this has changed, and this is also interesting. It's this trend that even though they didn't want to have it too proceduralized, they got it judicialized in a way, because it's an issue of rendering justice, it's an issue of administration of justice. Another aspect of this judicial feature has to do with publicity and maybe predictability and consistency. Publicity, this was not something that was very much cared about in the procedure when it was created, established by the World Bank. But in fact, it has become an important feature of the procedure. And there are very recent decisions which have been taken in this direction. But one of the important features, I think, is the fact that it has been decided in January 2011 that all decisions of the sanction board should be made public. Okay? So in addition to having the names of the companies and the individuals, now we're going also to have the decisions of the sanctions board which are going to be made public. And it's quite interesting also to look that, it also requested from the sanction board to give fully reasoned decisions, including both the basic facts of the case as well as the legal reasoning underpinning their decision. And it's interesting that in other circuits we're not asking that to the arbitrators or the judges, but there is an issue of full public explanation. The same has been decided for the decisions of the evaluation officer when they are not contested. Okay, but they are more brief. They should be more briefer than the ones of the sanctions board. But I think this is an interesting evolution because it shows that the civil society, the populations, are going to have access to all these decisions. They are going to be made public. And so, as we say, the court of public opinion will be able to assess the overall functioning of the procedure. And this is one of the features of domestic jurisdictions and so on. So that's an important element. The other element is that there might be an issue of predictability too, or even an issue of consistency. If we have public decision, if we have the decisions, if we want to assess them, we're also going to be checking the deviations, we're going to be looking at the interpretation, the qualifications which are given. And this, I think, is going also to strengthen the legal reasoning of the decisions of the evaluation officer and the sanctions board. So with that, it seems to me that all this, what I've sort of highlighted, goes in the same direction, that progressively we're going towards the establishment of a sort of jurisdictional procedure. Now, one might wonder, but why going towards this direction? What has made the bank going towards this direction? And that's the last point I'd like to address is, it seems to me that external factors have played an important role for pushing the bank towards this direction. And that's where I think that we can test the relationships between the internal legal order of an organization and the external order, being the international legal order. So it might be, the evolution might be an issue of willingness of the bank, but I think it's also an issue of constraint from the outside. And so the bank had also to change its attitude towards its practice of struggling about corruption and fraud. Now, what are these external factors which have conditioned the bank towards modifying its practices and its procedure? I think that the role played by audit reports is important. And if you look at the story of this, what has been said about the audit reports, you will see that there are two important reports which were given, one in the early 2000, and the panel was chaired by Richard Turnbull, who was a high official in the U.S. administration, and he also had an important role at the United Nations, and he pushed towards this two-tier approach. Okay, so that was one of the consequences of this first audit. Now, you might remember that Volcker also chaired an audit report not too long ago. And he also assessed the functioning of the procedure. But Volcker had more to do with looking at how the investigations were conducted, because there were a lot of criticism. And there I come to the point made by Michael, too much secrecy, too much confidentiality. And this is the point that Volcker made. He said, there might be a need for confidentiality, but there is also a need for publicity. So you have to find a fine balance between confidentiality and publicity. There is another element in terms of audit which is interesting, that the Volcker panel also recommended the creation of an independent advisory board. So it's sort of internal mechanism, but composed of external people. And when you look at the composition of this this independent advisory board, you will see that there are important key players sitting on this board. And among them, there is Mark Peace, who is a professor of criminal law and is also a famous writer about corruption issues, very independent mind, Swiss professor of law. And they have pushed also in their way. And they have pushed there to say that you should give more room, you should make more room to due process requirements and so on. So this panel has played a role. Now, another external factor which I think played a role is the fact that the bank knew that in establishing its procedure, it had also to ground this procedure in legal principles. And I think that the role played by what we call the global administrative law principles was important and crucial in a way that the bank, being pragmatic, like most of the international organization, looked at procedural principles and knew that due process, accountability, transparency were important parameters. So this, I think, is also important in the shaping of this procedure, is that there was some concern about these criteria being respected or not. So pushed by the external report, the reports of the audit panels, pushed by some criticism, the bank integrated and developed its procedure in accordance with this principle. Now, there is another issue, and I will conclude with that. There is, I think, another issue which is putting some pressure on the World Bank. And it has to do with the notion of immunities of international organizations. In a way that we all know that it's very difficult to bring an action against an international organization for the reasons that we know. And you have more and more articles and complaints about the fact that the bank being involved in commercial activities, the bank taking commercial decisions should also be accountable before domestic courts or other mechanisms so to justify the decision that it has taken. Now, there is a path which has been opened with respect to immunities, and it's a path which deals with human rights. There is now some acceptance at the European level and at the domestic level that in case of human rights consequences, the immunities could be of an international organization could be lifted. And we have some decisions with respect to the protection of the staff and the problem, the actions brought by staff members of an international organization. And a court, a domestic court or a European court, looking at the fairness, the due process requirements of the procedure established within the organization to decide if the immunity should be lifted or not. We have in mind, for example, the Waite and Kennedy case of the European Court of Human Rights, and the fact that the European Court has been speaking in terms of looking at alternative, reasonable alternative means to protect the rights under the convention. So the court, for the time being, the European Court has not gone far enough, has not yet decided about lifting the immunity of an organization. But it had sort of developed the reasoning towards this direction. Now, there is an interesting decision given by the Cour de Cassation of Belgium, which has decided that a specific mechanism in a specific organization, the Western European Union, was not abiding to the due process requirements and the European human rights standards. And because of that, the immunity of this organization was lifted. Now, it's interesting to be speaking with people from the World Bank in charge of the formatting of the procedure that I have mentioned, because they are all referring to these decisions. And they are all aware of the criteria, the reasoning that has been developed by the European Court of Human Rights and by the Cour de Cassation in Belgium. And they are looking at their own mechanism, and they know that there are certain weaknesses in terms of judicial parameters. Think of the composition of the sanction boards, think of the appointment of the official, the evaluation officer. And so there will be an audit which is going to be conducted this year. And I think that one of the outcomes might be that it will be recommended to the World Bank to change more drastically its decision. And I think it seems to me that we will be going towards the direction of a sanctions board composed of external members. And that would be that at that time, I think with criteria of impartiality and independent strength, and that would look like a jurisdiction. So I've been a bit too long, and I'm sorry about that. But the conclusion that I want to make is that, and it's interesting for all the mechanisms, accountability or sanction mechanisms that are created and established by an international organization, especially by the World Bank, is that when you look at them, it's a good they reveal the features of an international organization, the specificities of an international organization. And when you look at the profile, they reveal the dynamics we see in an international organization. But at the same time, it's quite interesting that there is an emancipation of these procedures from the specificities in a way that, yes, maybe there are certain specificities which would be preserved, but on the other hand, there are certain standards of international law which should be respected, which should be complied with. And because of that, these procedures are changed, they evolved, and more they look like jurisdiction or quasi-jurisdiction as we can find them in domestic system or in the international legal order. And I will conclude with a parallel drawn with the sanction procedure and the mechanism that has been put in place by the Security Council, the ombudsman or ombudsperson. She's a woman, the one who's assuming this position, which has been established. If you look at the decision of the European, the decision of the judiciary bodies of the European Union, we realize that they're not really, it seems that they're not really satisfied with what has been created in terms of guaranteeing a right to a fair trial. And this is where I think that even though you can speak of the specificities of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, of the Security Council, of the need for respecting the powers of the Security Council, when you speak of justice and when you speak in terms of access to justice, I do feel that there is just one model, a model which is created in accordance with human rights requirements. Thank you.